Hello and welcome to the Guelph Politicast. I'm Adam A. Donaldson of Guelph Politico. Last week, I took part in a reorientation training session at CFRU, and programming director Christopher Curry started off by getting everyone to break the ice by asking them about their dream interview. Who in the world would they like to interview, and maybe from what field would they like to interview someone from? Now, I've been doing this for a while, and I've interviewed all kinds of people, from city councillors to members of parliament, candidates, activists, administrators, comic book artists, actors, directors. I've even interviewed Robert Englund, and you really haven't lived till you've talked to Freddy Krueger on the telephone. But if there's one interview I've never done, and maybe it should have been on my list because of my own interest in history, it's a survivor of the Holocaust. And I did get my chance last week, and though it was a short interview, I still found it fairly insightful. So, the story of one survivor is the topic of this week's Guelph Politicast. Every year, Hillel Guelph holds events to mark Holocaust Remembrance Week with a number of different activities, but the two most notable are a traveling exhibit in an actual train car used to transport people to concentration camps, and a guest speaker who is a survivor. Next year will mark 75 years from the end of World War II and the liberation of the camps by the Allies. It's a milestone, to be sure, but it's also a reminder that the living voices of the ones who lived through this startling genocide will not be around for too much longer. Their stories will remain through a number of memorial and archival projects, but there's something very powerful hearing it directly from the person who lived through the experience and in a room full of other people who also came out to hear that story. The guest this year was Nate Leipziger. Leipziger was only 11 years old when the Nazis invaded his home in Poland, and he was 15 years old when he and his family were shipped to Auschwitz-Birkenau. Like thousands and thousands of people, that might have been where Leipziger's story might have ended. But his father's guile saved his life twice. Once when he was in line to be processed, which is the code word for being put to death in the gas chamber, and then again when his father convinced a Nazi officer to transfer them both out of Auschwitz. Leipziger and his father were eventually liberated from Dachau in April 1945, but his mother and sister never made it out of Auschwitz. So this week on the Guelph Politicast, you will hear Nate Leipziger tell his own story in his own words, and what drives him to still travel around and tell that story at the age of 91. And after that, you will hear my interview with Leipziger after the talk as I follow up on a couple of things and ask my own questions. So, from last week at the University of Guelph, in front of about 600 people who came out to hear his story, here is Nate Leipziger.
Today, 75 years after an event, what brings you out? What brings you out to listen to stories that happened 75 years ago? And yet, it is very timely that we talk about it because the situation in the world in the last 75 years has not changed very much. In 1948, when Mr. Lemming came up with the word of genocide, the definition of genocide, we thought that that would be a very much unused word. But today, unfortunately, we know that it is not a word that is unknown to us, because there have been many genocides since the genocide of the Shoah, of the Holocaust. When I came into this campus, I noticed the car, the railroad car, which some of your students have purchased or asked them, or was actually donated. And they're working on it to fit it out, to make it a traveling exhibit, a traveling venue. So you ask yourself, what is the significance of that railroad car? If there's one object that defines the Shoah, the Holocaust, it is that railroad car. I must explain. Before we went into the railroad car, we were civilians. We suffered in a ghetto, hunger, deprivation, but we were free. We could go to work, we could come home, we could go to a family, we could go out and visit our friends, we could actually go to a movie. Or so by 1943, there were no movies open to Jews. But we lived in a civilized society. Europe, 1940, 41, 43, was not different than Canada, United States in 1943. The society has moved on. Europe was a scientific community. Poets, musicians, philosophers, doctors, lawyers, all the professionals flourished in Europe. We had all the advantages of the 20th century. So how did we get into that railroad car? And that's where you come in. I want you to imagine that it is happening to you. You are living with your family, with your father, your mother, your uncles and aunts, and brothers and sisters. And suddenly your town is invaded by an army of soldiers that go from room to room, from house to house, and they order you to come the way you are. And it's July. It's hot. So what do you wear? A pair of pants? A thin dress? Maybe even wear shorts. And you ask your mate to leave your home, and you are shipped to a railroad, and you are moved to a railroad car, to a railroad yard, and you're forced onto a railroad, into that car. 80 to 100 people in a car. You see how small it is, and you wonder how could 80 people or 100 people be forced into that car? What do you do? What do you think? What is your emotion? What do you think is going to happen to you? Do you think you know? We did not. You have the hindsight of history. We did not. But in the middle of the 20th century, Jews have been emancipated. We have the freedom of vote. We could be citizens, which was not the case before 100 years earlier. But we were full citizens of the country that we lived in. I lived in Poland. Poland was occupied by three different nations. The Tsarist Russia, the Imperial Austria, and Germany. But by 1920, it became an independent country whose constitution was formed according to the American Constitution. And we had freedom. And suddenly, in the middle of the 20th century, in 1943, my family, my father, my mother, my sister, and I were unceremoniously removed from our ghetto, from our houses in the ghetto, which were not luxurious or anything like that. Our family lived in half a room. Half a room. How do you live in half a room? You put a curtain halfway through the room, and then one half your family lives, and the other half, another family lives. But these conditions were acceptable. They were, you know, we actually thought we were very badly off till a few days later, when suddenly we found ourselves in this railroad car, and we huddled together, the four of us, were pushed in from all sides because there was no room to sit down. But we huddled together, and my mother said, whoever survives will meet after the war as my mother's neighbor, a Christian woman. And my father tore open his lining and took out his last money that he had saved for a rainy day. This was the rainy day. He gave us all some money, and before we could even say goodbye or cherish the moment, we arrived at an unknown place. It was a field, a railroad siding in a field. Suddenly we heard noises. The door opened, and the railroad car door opened with a clank, and we heard dogs barking and some people shouting. Everybody out in German, everybody out. When we looked, we saw men in striped uniforms and Nazi soldiers dividing us into two groups. One group men, and one for the men, for the women. I stood with my mother and my sister. I didn't want to leave them. You see, as long as we were together as a family, no matter how bad it was, we could manage. We could support each other. No matter how little food we had, we could share it. No matter how much little clothes we had, we could share it. So we wanted to stay as a family. But at that moment that we left that railroad cart, we stopped being a family. We stopped being human. The significance of this car is just that. It is significant because it changes you from a civilian to a prisoner. A prisoner with no worth. I was standing with my mother and my sister, and my father came over to me and he yanked me by my sleeve and says, you come with me. He wanted me to go with the man. And there we were, except two columns, woman's column and man's column. And there was a Nazi officer directing traffic with one hand. He motioned this way or that way. He motioned my father to one side, and when he got to my father came up to him, he gave him an order to line up the man that he sent him in row of five. And with a flick of a wrist, he directed me to go to the other side. I was standing there with my uncle, some cousins, some boyfriends, and we were lined up in a row of five, and it stretched for many rows. And I was trying to assess what's happening. Suddenly a new situation. What can this be? We were not in a vacuum. There were many evacuations before, and they told us that people who are being evacuated by these railroad cars are going to be shipped to Europe, to the eastern part of Poland, and they're going to establish new communities, that there will be better lodging, more food, and jobs. But that was happening to others. It wasn't happening to me. Suddenly it's happening to me, and I'm standing there and I'm trying to figure out what's happening. And I see my mother and my sister together with the young people. And I see my father lining up the young man. And I'm here with the older uncle, as I said, my younger cousins. So this is my reasoning. They're going to go to Germany, to a labor camp, which has been happening for the last 3 years of occupation by the Nazis of Poland. People were sent to German forced labor camps. So I wasn't worried about them. And I wasn't worried about myself. Because by that time, in 1943, I was 15 years old. At the age of 12, I became an electrician's helper. I had a trade. I could look after myself. I wasn't worried. So by the age 15, I had absolutely no worry that I should be able to look after myself. So I figured I'll be here, wherever it is was, because we didn't know where it was. And this is where they're going to resettle us. I had going through these thoughts, and I was trying to evaluate the situation when I heard my father calling my name. At first it didn't register because I didn't expect him to call me. Suddenly he started frantically shouting my name, and I realized it was me he was looking for. So I jumped out of the line, and he was standing there with a Nazi officer, and he was saying, "This is my son. He's 17 years old. And he's an electrician." The Nazi didn't want to believe my father. I was 15, but I looked like 12. The Nazi officer asked me some question about what I was doing. I answered in perfect German. And he says, "Okay, take him." And he took me from one column and he put me into another. A few minutes later, we were marched off. We were taken into an empty barrack. We were told to remove our clothes, give up anything that we had in our possession. I was clutching the $5 Canadian American dollars that my father gave me at the last moment, and I didn't want to give it up. But then the couple who was a prisoner said, "You better give everything up, because if you don't, if they search you and they find something on you, you're going to be punished very severely." And then they shore our hair and they disinfect our bodies and they put a number on our arm, 133,628. My father caught up with me, and he was standing behind me, and his number was 133,629. That was it. I stopped being a human being. I became a number. No name, no clothes, no possessions, just a number. And then we were given a lecture. They say, "You are in Auschwitz too, Birkenau. And if you don't behave, you're going to join your brothers and sisters and mothers and fathers who are being processed now." Processed. What does that mean? So he explained, he said, "They're being gassed to death." How does your mind can accept what he just said? People are being gassed to death? Was there a trial? Did they commit a crime? Why should they die? And such horrible death by gassing. How do you accept that? How does a human mind capable of accepting the horrors of that message that you just heard? To this day, I don't know how it happened. But there it was. Our people are being gassed to death. Why? What crime have we committed? My crime was that I was born Jewish. Do you have a choice for who you're born to? You know the answer. I didn't have the choice, and neither do you. So my penalty for having been born was death. Death by gassing. Soon after, we were marched out of the barracks into our living quarters, which are horse barn. 800 to 1,000 people per barn. And that's how my life as a prisoner of the Third Reich started. To be starved, to be frozen, and to die. My sentence did not have a limit. It wasn't for 5 years or 10 years or 20 years. It was till my life ended. And that's how our journey as prisoners of concentration camps started. How were a different experience? But the end result was the same. We were all destined to die for only one reason, and that was the fact that we were different than the Nazis, the Aryan race, which was supposed to rule the world. And all of you who are not Aryan, what does that mean? That you have to have blonde hair and blue eyes? Hitler himself didn't have those. But it was the ideal of the Aryan race, that they were going to inherit the world and they're going to rule it for thousands of years. So it didn't matter if Hitler won. It wouldn't have mattered where you were. It was a long process. We're hiding. I had to hide in Auschwitz-Birkenau every week because there was a selection. They were looking for young kids or sick people who went through the first selection, and after 2 weeks, they may have gotten sick. We were in a quarantine camp. A quarantine lager, a quarantine camp, which was there to determine either you're going to be shipped to Germany or work in Auschwitz or in some other camp, or you're going to be processed. By now you know what processed means. So we were there in this camp. And every week I had to hide with my father in a latrine or another barrack before the selection went through, and we were lucky that they didn't count before and they only counted after they removed the people that they wanted to remove. And this was going on like that for 3 months. After 3 months, the biggest problem being in that Durchgangslager, in the transition camp, was the people who were being shipped to crematoria gas chamber number 3 and 4, or 4 and 5, had to go past our camp. And week after week, day after day, thousands of people were brought in. And we were sitting there outside the barracks. And we saw these people going to their death, being marched. Innocent people, not knowing what was happening, going to happen to them, because they trusted the state. And they were being shipped or walked to the gas chamber, to their death. And we sat there. And we cried to God, now is the time for a miracle. If there was ever a time for a miracle, that was it now. If there was ever a time for Messiah to come, for the Messiah to arrive, whether it's the first time or the second time, we were saying, this is the time. But there was no miracle. Nobody listened. The people outside the world in 1943 knew what was happening to the Jewish people in Germany or in occupied Poland. And they chose not to do anything. And if you want to go into the Google and Google Roosevelt's life and his secret information or writings, you'll find that he knew and he didn't want to intervene. Because it wouldn't look good for his next election to speak out in favor of the Jews, to try to save the Jews, and maybe to speak out against the Nazis or the Germans. That was the reality of the world. And today, you even wonder today, what has changed? Are we different? We knew when Rwanda was being, people were massacred to death in Rwanda. And we knew about what was happening in Darfur. Only very few of us took the time to march and to walk and to tell our government that they have to intervene. When we were there, nobody was. Nobody marched. Few people in New York did. The very, very religious people marched around this White House to demonstrate and to tell them that they have to do something. But their plea fell on deaf ears. Finally, my father volunteered to go to work because he heard that when the work, the detail went to a place that they met up with the women. And he wanted to meet my mother and my sister, hoping that he would be able to see them. Because remember, they were among the young, so he thought that they survived the selection. So he went to work to give them an idea that I am alive, that I'm alive, that I'm with him. Why was that important? You see, the only thing he had in that situation is hope. Hope that you would survive, that somebody else with you will survive. Such a basic element, hope. But it determined whether you would survive or not. So he wanted to give my mother hope that I was alive. Evening came. It got dark. The flames were shooting out of the crematorium chimney. And my father was not coming back. I panicked. What am I going to do by myself? I knew I had very little chance of survival. Suddenly he arrived, much after dark. He came with parcel under his arm. I ran over to him and greeted him and hugged him. And I said, what happened? What's you got under the arm? He says, it's new clothes for you. You see, when I came to Auschwitz, as I told you, I looked like a 12-year-old boy. And they gave me a grown man's clothing. And I looked like a scarecrow when I put them on, with my rolled up sleeves and my rolled up pants. So he knew how important it was to get some clothes. So I said, "What happened?" And he wouldn't admit to me what happened till after the war, he told me. When he came back from the workplace and he didn't find my mother, they went into the camp, was known as Canada, where there were showers and new fresh uniforms. And he was taken there to get a shower. And after the shower, when he was dressing, he met a man who he knew from before the war, who was the capo of the tailor shop in Canada. Canada was a camp that the prisoners named, because that was where the people working in that camp, in that section of the camp, were processing the clothing that were brought from outside, and they were sorting them, repairing them, looking for hidden valuable objects, and then the clothes would be sent to Germany for distribution. So they had access to more food and better working condition. So being in a Canada camp meant life. And my father told me that he met that couple there, and he offered him that he could stay in Canada and work as a tailor. But he told me after the war that he refused to stay because he wanted to be with me. He told the couple that. And the couple told him, he says, "You're being foolish. Your son does not have a chance. It's not a question of if, it's a question of when they're going to find him. So save yourself. Take the job." My father says, "No, I have to go and be with him." But he said, "I want you to give some clothes for my son that can fit him." My father knew my size. He went to the warehouse and he selected a coat. He selected a set of riding breeches, riding boots, and a jacket that fit me. I stood out by the fact that I had civilian clothes in the camp that fitted me. And selections every week were going on anyways. And then suddenly another selection came around. And this time they were not looking for sick people, for people who had swollen hands or swollen faces, indication of malnutrition. But they were looking for strong men, big men with muscles. And my father said, "Let's line up. Maybe it's a transport to go to Germany." And that's what it was. So we lined up. And of course, my father, who was a big man, was accepted, and I was rejected. My father got dressed. And he tried to go to the commandant and tried to convince him, like he convinced the other soldier, to let me go with him. And he almost got shot, because to address a Nazi officer was a audacity which was usually punished by a bullet to your head. But he persisted. The couple that was in charge of the men that were selected to was preventing him from going, and my father was trying to go around and push him aside. And the officer noticed that there's something happening. He says, "What's happening?" And he said, "This idiot wants to come and talk to you." He says, "Let him come." My father came over to him, and there was a Nazi officer of a higher rank. And he said, "Sir, my son is on the other side. I would like him to come with me. He's an electrician. He's 17 years old." And the Nazi officers got mad. He started shouting at my father. Instead of shooting him, he shouted at him. He says, "Don't you know that there's war?" He said, "My wife is in Germany. My son is on the East Front, and I'm here doing this lousy job." And then he stopped. I was standing just a few feet away from him, observing this whole situation. And then, after a few seconds, he said to my father, "Where is he?" My father motioned to me, and I jumped up. Now this time I was wearing riding boots, and I clicked my heels, and I stretched myself as tall as I could. And I spoke perfect German, because we lived in a part of Poland that before 1920 was Germany. And he asked me a few questions. He was surprised that I spoke perfect German. And he says, "Okay, wait here." And I was standing on the side of the selection while the doctor went on and kept on selecting the men that were coming through the barracks to him. And then finally the doctor motioned to him and he says, "I have the number that we want, which was 600. So he said to me, he said, "Go give the doctor your number. That's all that counted, the number." So I gave him my number, and he wrote it down. I was 601 in a 600-man transport. They took 49 others, just in case somebody got sick or somebody died, and they couldn't go in a transport, they wanted 600 men. So for 2 weeks we were quarantined in a separate barrack. We were given better food. We were exercised every day, jumping, running, jogging, hurdles, jumping hurdles to see who is fit. Everybody knew that being in this group of men meant life. Nobody got sick. Nobody faltered. Nobody got hit. All knew that this meant life. 2 weeks went by. I was lying there on the bunk and looking at the man in front of me and saying, "Who is going to be the one that's going to give up his place for me? Of course, nobody did. Everybody realized that this was life. For a while anyways. And the time came. The 600 men were dressed, they were shaved, they were ushered uniforms, striped uniforms. Before that we were in the camp, we wore a civilian uniform with some civilian clothes with a KZ on the back, or KL on the back. And just then, a Nazi officer walks in and says, "Everybody get dressed. Everybody's leaving." 650 men left Auschwitz. After the war, I checked the records. Only 600, according to the records, left. The 50 of us that went as well, there's no record of them. As far as their books are concerned, I don't exist. That's what saved my life, that I did not exist in their books. So what else can I tell you? The thing that's happening now is what I have to ask you, what you're going to do. You see, now you have part of my story. You will all receive my copy of my book. Well, you'll find the rest of the details and the rest of my survival till May 1945, where I was deathly ill after a number of camp transfers, after a number of death marches and death trains. We found ourselves in Bavaria, beautiful German state, in forest camp, where birds were singing, and in early spring the trees were sprouting their beautiful leaves. Nature went on as if nothing happened. I was deathly ill. On May the 2nd, somebody came running into our infirmary, which where I was because I was sick, and shouted, "The Americans are here! We're free!" Just as you can't absorb the idea that your family is being murdered, you couldn't absorb the concept of freedom. A few minutes after, we finally realized what these words meant. That the guards are gone. Now became the most important quest. We survived, barely. Most of us were sick. But who else survived? Who else survived? We knew that the Nazis were murdering, not only in concentration camps, but in forests by shooting in the eastern part of Poland. Millions of people were being shot to death. By that time, we knew everything. Suddenly, we were free, but our freedom came very late. And we were wondering who of our families would survive. Of course, not very many did. And those who found a brother, like my friend Howard Chandler, were rare. You could count them. There were so few. Most were left like a thumb. By itself. Or maybe like with me, my father, the two of us, and Howard and his brother, the two of them together. But we were exceptions. Most people have lost everyone. Whole families were wiped out. Whole villages wiped out. Nobody left. So what do you do from there on? It was a very long way of recovery to get to back to health, to accept normality as a form of life. Freedom, freedom of choice as a new situation. It took a long time. And then, where are you going to go? Some people went to Poland. And they were not welcome. Some were murdered, some were beaten, some were chased away. In other countries, the same thing happened. The possessions were gone, others had moved in, it was theirs. They said, "You don't have a right to it, it's mine, I was given it to by my government. You don't have a right to it anymore. You're not supposed to be here. You're not supposed to exist anymore." Well, we were lucky. We applied my father's only surviving brother. There were eight of them, four brothers and four sisters. His oldest brother in 1912 came to Canada from Poland. So was the only one that survived. All of his brothers and sisters and sister-in-law and brother-in-laws were gone. In 1940, 5, September 1945, after 2 months of recovery in a hospital from typhus fever, I made my way to Poland, to my mother's neighbor. When I knocked on the door, and she opened the door and she saw me and she started sobbing, I knew what the answer was. This is September. The war ended in May. Many months after, they had an opportunity to come back. So I knew if they weren't there, they may not come back. My mother's two sisters came back. They were fortunate. You see, the shining lights, the only shining light in an absolutely dark night were the righteous among the nations, Christians, who took it upon themselves to save Jewish life at the risk of their own life and the life and the end, the life of their family. I ask you, you're sitting here now, how many of you would be willing to open up your doors, your homes, to a stranger because they were threatened? You examine your own mind. I know what's in my mind. I have great doubts whether I would do it. But those people did it. I don't know why they did it, but they did it. And if you ask them, why did you do it? Because I had no choice. What do you mean you had no choice? You had your choice of saying no. But thousands upon thousands of people said yes. And they accepted hundreds of Jewish families into their homes, into their hiding places, and they survived. Two men that I know did this for my aunts. They hid them, and they survived. It takes a special person to do that. And I don't know if you know who that person is. And you can't tell what you would do till you're confronted with the situation. Nobody sitting here can tell me that yes, I would do that, or no, I wouldn't do it. It is the circumstances that govern what you would do. And we were lucky that two men in my family saved my two aunts who survived. They came back, and I saw them. And we knew that my mother and my sister would not come back. But my hope that I find them alive did not diminish. I thought that they maybe get sick, maybe they got into another country. Some people went to Sweden, some people went to Italy, some people went to other countries because they were transported, because they were sick. Maybe they were among them. Of course, as year went by, our hope reduced, and we finally had to accept that they're not coming back. And then you have to rebuild your life. Here I am in Germany, living as a 17-year-old boy among my enemies, among the people who wanted to destroy me. And I'm going walking down the street, and I'm looking at faces, and I'm saying, was he a guard, or was he a guard? Or did he push people through the gas chamber? Or how was he involved? Did he vote for Hitler? Or did he say, was he high, as all the millions of people did? 3 years, difficult years. But I knew that I had to have a future. You see, if he asked me the day before I was liberated, what were you going to do when you're going to be liberated and you're going to go out in the streets and you're going to have access to a gun? What are you going to do? I had no question in my mind as to what I would do. I would take the gun and I would shoot every single German that I would see. What revenge? But when I was confronted with the reality of the fact that I could do that, it was a different situation. We went into the houses of farmers looking for food after we were liberated from our camp. And they said, I didn't do anything. Please don't harm me. I said, we're not harming you. We're not here to harm you. We're here to look for some food. It wasn't in us to take revenge of that kind. I do not say that they were not individuals who didn't take revenge. But the majority, the vast majority, were not of that ilk. We're just human beings, wanted to live and let others live. And that has to be today our motto. We live in a beautiful country. We are a country of immigrants. It is upon us to open up our gates, to let the persecuted peoples into Canada, just as we were let into Canada. And it's up to us to accept the people who come, not tolerate them. Tolerate is not acceptable, but to accept them. To accept them the way they are. Not to say I will tolerate you till you become like me, but to accept them the way they are. Regardless of the skin or hair color or eye color, regardless of the language that they speak or the religion that they profess, we have to have mutual acceptance. What does mutual acceptance mean? I mean, I will accept you as you are, or you, provided that you accept me the way I am. You don't want to change me, I don't want to change you. We should be able to have the right to follow our religion and our customs, but have common laws, laws of the country, that protect all of us, not just one group. And our country hasn't been always that wonderful anyways. For hundreds of years, we wouldn't accept the other, predominantly our indigenous people. We wouldn't accept them. We would label them savages. We would say their religion is barbaric. Their customs do not fit our society. Their living style and language do not coincide with our understanding of what it means to be a Canadian. So we discriminated against them, we sent them to separate the children from the parents, in the words of some politician, to kill the Indian within the child. We did that in Canada. We separated them from their parents. We wanted to kill their religion. We almost did. We definitely wanted to kill their language, which we almost did. We almost wanted to kill their culture, which we almost did. So where are we today? We had the Truth and Reconciliation Commission that came up with wonderful means of solving the problem that we created in the first place. But many of us say, well, why should I pay my taxes to support these people who live on reservations or live in the city and they get free this and free that? You know why? Because we are guilty. We are not guilty, but we are responsible for the conditions in which they find themselves. As a society, as a country, we have it upon our responsibility to help them to regain the language, to regain their religion, to regain their schools, so that they can teach their children of their wonderful heritage, which they had for 10,000 of years before the white men arrived on these shores. That, my dear friends, is our responsibility. We're not guilty. Of course not. We didn't do it. Our forefathers maybe did it. But what it is we are responsible for the condition in which they find themselves. And that's why I'm going to leave you with this message, that we have to accept the other person, not tolerate them, but to accept them. A big difference between tolerating and acceptance. Just think of it. Because not tolerating, you say, I'm going to tolerate you till you become like me. That's not good enough. So my dear friends, we are of different ethnic backgrounds. And we come from different parts of the world. And we sit here together and we can learn together, we can live together as people, as Canada, as a wonderful country. And with this, my dear friends, I thank you for your attention and for being here and for listening to me. And I have great hopes. And I know you want a club. I know you want a club. I want a club. I want to applaud you for being here and listening to me. And therefore, if you feel so, you can do that.
You talked about how after the war you were out in your old community and you were looking at the faces and wondering, you know, who was a Nazi, who was a guard of the prison camp. But I also saw an interview you did where you were talking about when the Nazis invaded and you were at school and it seemed like it just kind of changed overnight how people you knew in your neighborhood and your friends at school, like their attitudes towards you and your family just changed overnight. How do you, as a kid, how do you sort of comprehend that? That, you know, it's just this one little thing changes and all of a sudden the whole world is different.
You know, it took me many years to realize that the people that suddenly turned against me, that was not sudden, but it was there. But the time was such that the opportunity arose to express their feelings the way they really felt, they really believed. Because, you know, in our civilized world, we are not civilized. We are civilized not to hurt the others. But when the opportunity comes, it does. The same thing happened when Trump became part of the president of the United States. Those people who came out and spoke about anti-Semitism, xenophobia, and hatred did not suddenly become that. They were there all the time, just that the opportunity has been such that now they could speak freely without being ostracized. So the same thing happened when I was a kid. It didn't occur to me at that time. I was very much surprised. We stayed at home. We didn't go out on the street. We played in our room because we saw that the outside world was very hostile.
Yeah. It makes me wonder, how do you approach trust after that? You know, how do you look at other people and new people and say, how can I, looking at you today, how do I know that is you?
Because, you know, it was very easy to become a misanthrope. Nobody would blame me if that happened. But, you know, you have to examine as to what the world really is. And as I spoke about the righteous among the nations, who were the bright stars in an almost dark night, that gave me hope that humanity cannot be written off, that we are here, and given the opportunity, we will reach out to each other. And we will be civil and we will work together because it's our common world. We are in this, like in this one bathtub. What happens to one happens to the other.
Yours is an interesting story of hope because
your survival depended on these like moments where the humanity did come through. The story you told about your father talking to the guard and
you noticed that there were two SS men.
Yeah.
That they knew what they were doing.
Yeah.
They knew that by letting me go from one to the other, they were saving my life.
Right.
What motivated them? Do you know?
I couldn't. My guess would be humanity.
Was that no matter how bad you are, there you're still a human being.
Mm.
And if you let yourself realize that for a moment, you can be humane instead of being a vicious person destined to inclined to destroy the other.
Mm. I wonder if your father ever talked about his brazenness in those situations, you know, where he found the strength to, in those moments, just act in a way that, from, you know, what I've learned about the Holocaust is like quite uncommon. You know, there was every chance that he could have been punished for talking out of turn to a Nazi officer.
Absolutely right. That's what I said, that he didn't know whether he's going to pull out his gun and shoot him,
yeah,
or whether he's going to listen to him. But he felt that I was the last thing that he had with him. I think that he felt that without me, there was not worthwhile living.
Mm.
I think that there was a certain amount of maybe giving up hope, but at the end, he did retain his hope.
Mm.
And, you know, there were moments where I gave up hope, almost, and he became very angry with me for giving up hope.
Mm. What was that like? Because I imagine, I can't really imagine, but I mean, this circumstance, and you touched on this, it's like you went into the camp knowing that your future was down to zero, that you couldn't guarantee you would make it to the end of the hour, let alone the end of the day, let alone the end of the year. So, you know, talk about the definition of hopelessness.
Well, that's the strength and the wisdom of Viktor Frankl when he writes Man in Search of Meaning. And Man's Search of Meaning. And it's easy to give up when you have no vision of hope.
Mm.
And but I think that we all have the desire to live.
Mm.
And it's a very strong desire to live. We can be indoctrinated that there is a different type of life after,
right,
and that it is worthwhile giving up your life on this earth for hope of something else. That is a big if.
Mm.
And some people fall for it, and that's the tragedy of the suicide bomber who straps on a bomb, you know, with the intent of killing himself and maybe others. It's something that I totally do not understand, and I just don't want to go there.
I imagine there's something to be said about hope now. I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, you're 91?
Yes.
You know, you're doing this, talking to people like me, talking to this huge group of young people here tonight about history, about your experience. And I did see an interview with you where you said it takes a toll. You know, the memories are harder to keep from coming back up as the older you've gotten. How do you, I guess, keep going, doing these? Where do you find that strength? Where do you find that hope?
My hope really lies in the memory of my parents, my mother and my sister, my people of my religion, who were murdered, in cold blood. Their echo, their voice is speaking to me, and I cannot ignore it.
We live in such a divided time. People sort of shoot from the hip on social media. It seems like hate is the fallback. You experienced real hate. How did you find the strength to be the person, to be the bigger man, to sort of let these things go? And how, you know, what can you sort of teach people today who are that sort of quick to react with hate? You know, how do they become less hateful?
You just have to examine the what hate does to you and the element of hate. If I hate you and you don't know about it, it doesn't hurt you. It only hurts me.
Right.
Because it makes my life miserable. It makes me feel, bitter. And there's no fallback on that. There's nothing to gain by hating. I mean, if you see something wrong, you got to get angry. Anger is good because it motivates you to do something about what you see that's wrong. But hatred doesn't do anything. It just destroys the person that does the hating.
And once again, that was Nate Leipziger, and you can get Leipziger's book, The Weight of Freedom, wherever you get your fine books. And to learn more about Hillel Guelph, you can visit their website at hillelontario.org. That's H-I-L-L-E-L Ontario.org. And to hear another story of survival, this week's Open Sources Guelph will feature Robert McCabe, a survivor of abuse by a Catholic priest who now helps other survivors. McCabe is sponsoring a screening of the documentary Prey on Saturday at the River Run Center, and we will also be speaking to the film's director, Matt Gallagher. That is Thursday at 5 p.m. on CFRU. And that's it for this edition of the Guelph Politicast. The music for the Guelph Politicast comes from KPM Classics and Sid Dale. The Guelph Politicast is recorded at CFRU at the University Center on the University of Guelph campus. And to learn more about CFRU, go to cfru.ca. You can download the Guelph Politicast from iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and Spotify, or you can download it from the host on Podbean at guelphpoliticast.podbean.com. When you subscribe to the Guelph Politicast channel, you will also get an episode of Open Sources Guelph on Mondays and an episode of End Credits on Friday. You can get in touch with me by email at adamadonaldson@gmail.com, reach me through Twitter at adamadonaldson, or on Guelph Politico. There is also the Guelph Politico Facebook page at facebook.com/politicoguelph, and if you'd like to help build a locally sourced independent media outlet in the city of Guelph, then please consider donating to Guelph Politico, and you can find out how at guelphpolitico.ca/donate. For all the latest local political news, check out guelphpolitico.ca, where there will be a new episode of the Guelph Politicast for you next week, and until then, see you next time.